Apple doesn't have something in that category, and it's proving to be like a pretty good idea for certain people, I encourage them to put out experiments and to try riskier things. The iPhone, the way it is now, is very good, but kind of boring. They should put out cool stuff like that. And if other people can do it, they can do it too. And they can probably, if they put their minds to it, do a better job. So despite all of the inherent trade-offs and weirdnesses about folding phones, the fact is people use them, people love them, and they can be pretty good. So I want Apple to make one. And I'm glad whenever I hear these rumors that it seems like they're taking that seriously and will actually put one out, even though I know it will have massive trade-offs. That's the name of the game. The iPad had massive trade-offs, but I'm glad Apple released an iPad, and you know, this is the same thing.
Yeah, I feel like a folding phone is one of those things that, sitting here now, I'm like, yeah, I guess that's neat. I don't know if it would be for me or not, but I guess it's neat. And then especially, and I'm jumping ahead and I apologize, John, but John had put in the show notes a video that MKBHD did.
Oh, don't jump ahead. You're killing me here.
Just it's relevant.
We can just do two more short things before we get to that.
All right, listeners, I've been told, breaking news, that I'm not allowed to jump ahead even to make a relevant point. So instead, I will plow forward as it was demanded. All right, so Apple's foldable iPad Pro prototype features under-display Face ID. According to the Weibo-based leaker Digital Chat Station, one of Apple's engineering prototypes features an 18.8-inch foldable screen with a, quote, metal superstructure lens, quote, that integrates the receiver and transmitter components of Face ID for under-display facial recognition.
So that would be like enabling technologies of like a folding thing. One of your problems you have is like, oh, now we have like less room underneath the screen for stuff. And this combines with all the rumors about upcoming iPhones having things under the screen. The notch gave way to the dynamic island, which could give way to a hole punch, which Android phones have had forever. But then what do you do with Face ID? Well, maybe we can get Face ID under the screen. Maybe we can get the cameras under the screen and finally achieve the goal of a complete screen iPhone with no notch, no hole, no nothing. Anyway, Face ID might not fit behind a folding phone or even a folding iPad. I have no idea what a metal superstructure lens is, but you know this. How long have we been hearing about underscreen stuff? And it exists on other platforms. This is another place where Apple has been sitting it out and saying other people are doing underscreen stuff, but their underscreen stuff isn't as good. Remember the underscreen fingerprint readers on Android phones? And Apple's like, yeah, we'll stick to Touch ID. They're still sticking with Touch ID. They don't have underscreen fingerprint readers. They use the power button on things that don't have Face ID. And cameras and other things behind the screen, same deal. They're like, oh, other people do them. Apple's not ready to go there yet. But they're still trying, I guess, and they might be forced to for a folding phone.
Then six things to know about Apple's upcoming foldable phone. I find this so funny because nobody knows what's going on, but apparently MacRumors
does. In the headline.
This is like a recent. So we've read a lot of articles that have been months and months ago, but this is a summary of everything that like the consensus leaks about the foldable phone as of like yesterday.
Right. So six items. Number one, Apple wants to make it creaseless. Number two, it'll open like a book. And that actually is relevant because sometimes they open the other direction. So it's kind of like a tent, if you will. But no, it'll open like a book. Three, for size, imagine the iPad mini. Four, 9 to 9.5 millimeters thick when closed. Five, it might have Touch ID due to thickness limits. Uh-huh. And six, it will be expensive, between $2,000 and $2,500. Yikes.
Yeah, so the thickness thing of it having Touch ID. So where do they put the Touch ID? There's not enough room for a Touch ID power button at these thicknesses. Is it an underscreen Touch ID, or have they figured out some way with a middle superstructure lens to put Face ID underneath the screen and the thing? Now, finally, we come to the MKBHD video, and you can make your point, Casey.
Oh, thanks, Dad. All right, so MKBHD put up a video about this Oppo Find N5, which seems to be a very, very well-executed Android folding phone. And at a glance, like it, I wouldn't say it looks like an iPhone or anything like that, but you can tell that it was competently done. You know, it's very, very thin. I think MKBHD said it's roughly the same thickness as a 15 Pro or 16 Pro Max, I believe.
Well, most importantly about the thickness, because when we talk about the thickness of the phone, the most relevant thing is when it is unfolded, how thick is it? And why is that relevant? Because if the phone has a port on it of any kind, and the Oppo Find N5 does have a port, you are limited by, here it is, we talked about it years and years ago, the thickness of USB-C is the limiting factor in the thickness of the phone. Go look at the Oppo Find N5 in this video. You will see, when unfolded, the USB plug plugs into one of the parts, and it is literally the thickness of a USB plug with the thinnest piece of metal above and below it. You can't make it any thinner. That's it. We're at the limit. Unless you either go portless or you have some kind of like magnetically attaching dongle or thing or like, but if you want to plug a USB-C port in, Oppo's done it. They have made it. It's the thinnest stick of pot. Now they can make the other half thinner, I suppose, to remove the overall thickness, but that's something, right? And if you're wondering, like, Oppo, this is a shipping product, not a prototype, not a rumor, not a thing. It's a thing that you can buy with money right now. And the beauty of it is when you do fold it up, if you're watching the video, it looks, MKBHD makes this point because he's been reviewing these Android folding phones forever. It looks almost like a regular phone when it's folded up.
Yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
It doesn't look like, because the old ones basically look like originally like two giant iPhones stuck together. Like they were huge when they were folded. Sometimes they didn't even stick all the way together because the crease, remember the one that like didn't actually close? Like the crease wouldn't close all the way as it was like teardrop shaped when mm-hmm. it was closed. They used to be giant, but the Android folks have been working and now the N5, it looks almost like a regular phone. And that's like, now we're getting into the territory where you look at that and you're like, okay, now Apple should feel comfortable, because if they can do that, then Apple can do that. And that means Apple can ship a folding phone that basically looks like a regular iPhone, but happens to unfold.
Yeah. And that's kind of the thesis of MKBHD's video. And, you know, as he so often is, it's very astute. And the thesis is basically, look, when it's no compromise, with the way I'm summarizing it doesn't make it sound very interesting, but he does a good job of coming up with something or distilling the thought of, once there's no compromise, then that's when consumers will buy them. And, you know, right now it's compromise city. And as I was starting to say before I was told I was not allowed to continue, that, you know, I'm looking at this Oppo Find N5, and it, again, is extremely competently done. I'm not sure that it's something I want, but it's clearly competently done in a way that I haven't seen folding phones done previously. And I can imagine finding an Apple version of this to be quite attractive, maybe not aesthetically, but in terms of like, I want one of these. I don't feel like I have a folding phone shaped hole in my life, but I think if this were to come out, you know, assuming the cameras aren't utterly crippled, which is tough because they might be, because, you know, the each of these halves has to be so darn thin. But assuming the cameras aren't utterly crippled, I would probably get this and at least have it for a year and see what I think. And maybe I'll decide, nope, not for me. But I would definitely give it a shot, in a way that I do not plan to get the alleged 17 Air, because the camera situation is so crippled. And I'm not willing to give up the pro cameras, whether or not I actually need them. I feel like I need them and I feel like I use them, and I'm not willing to give those up. And so if and when the 17 Air or whatever it's called arrives, I don't plan to get one because I don't want to give up the cameras. And if this does have decent cameras, then yeah, I probably will give this a try.
I mean, it's going to have worse cameras than the Air because it'll be thinner. Like the halves will be thinner than the Air, I'm assuming.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, so I'm guessing it has the same camera situation as the Air.
Yeah,
it probably will.
So there's a bunch of enabling technologies you need to make this happen, right? One of them is you need enough to make this happen within the constraints that Apple usually applies to their products, right? Although, again, Vision Pro is a counterexample here, but you would imagine, and the rumors are for the iPhone Air, that Apple doesn't want to massively compromise on battery life for having a thin one. The rumors about the 17, the slimmer 17, iPhone 17, is that the battery life won't be horrendously worse than the regular phones. Same thing with the Oppo Find N5. There have been advances in battery technology that allow for reasonable battery life in a phone that has three screens. Because first of all three screens aren't lit up all the time. At most you have, or you know, two screens, but it's like three area-wise. Anyway, you're not looking at both the back and the front at the same time, so I would imagine one of the screens is always off, and that helps. And the second, I forget, there's a new chemical formulation for batteries that helps give them higher capacity with a lower thickness. That's an enabling technology that needs to happen. Another enabling technology for Casey, to Casey's point, is if you don't want to compromise on cameras, you need some way to get decent cameras into a thin case. the rumors are that the iPhone 17 or iPhone 17 Air, the Slim 17, is going to compromise in camera because they don't have the ability to put as good or as many cameras in such a thin phone. Foldable is going to have to be thinner than that if it's not going to be a giant chonker, you know, thinner than the Air. The N5 compromises on cameras. It's so darn thin. Someone in the chat room said they should add a port bump. Like, yeah, you could, if you wanted to add a bump for the port, you can do that. But like, as you make the thing thinner, it makes your other problems harder. How do you deal with the camera situation? Like, oh, we can make it thinner and thinner. All right, it's great. It's, and now when I fold it up, it's the thickness of a quote-unquote regular phone. What do you do about the cameras? It's a problem because you only have half that width, or maybe you have like three quarters of that width. If it's not uniform thickness when you open it up, it's like one side is thicker than the other. But that's a problem they have to deal with. And Apple also has to deal with Face ID, which they were just talking about in that rumor about the iPad. What do you do about Face ID? Are you going to sell a phone without Face ID? Where are you going to put Touch ID? You can't put it on the edges of this thing. It's so skinny. Are you going to have an underscreen Touch ID, a thing that Apple has never done or that they decided was never up to their quality standards? So there are still, like, there's enough enabling technologies for Oppo to put out this phone that I think is meets the criteria of, like, this is almost like a normal Android phone except horrendously expensive. Battery life is okay. The screens are amazing. The size and weight is okay. It does unfold into a giant thing, but Android world doesn't have the same standards for ubiquitous face ID and or Touch ID of the quality and security of Apple's. They've just never, like, that hasn't been a universal requirement. They've been willing to ship phones without Face ID, phones with fingerprint sensors that are not secure as Touch ID or whatever, because it's a bigger market. It's not one company dictating the standards. They make lots of things for lots of people. So it seems like a valid, you know, Android phone. I don't think right now, 2025, is the right time for Apple to ship a foldable phone, because I don't think enough technologies are available. And I feel kind of like the Slimmer 17 is like a trial balloon. Not just a marketing test of, like, let's test our ability to make things thinner, let's test our thin battery technology, let's test our thin camera technology, but also see, do people hate this? Are they going to be like Casey and say, oh, I would buy it, but I won't compromise on camera? Like, that will help them decide, should we go with the foldable phone or not? Like, are the trade-offs desirable enough that the Apple market wants it? And to that end, one of the most interesting things I thought was in this video is MKBHD musing on the supposed utility of folding phones based on his personal experience. Yeah, you open it up and there's just this giant screen. He had some angles on, like, okay, what does Android do with that giant screen? And historically, Android apps have not taken advantage of all the space available to them. It's one of the reasons Android tablets have never really caught on, because there's not a lot of development and applications to like make good use of the larger screen available, even if you go from a phone all the way up to a tablet. So with folding phones, first of all, you need all the apps to be at least aware enough that they have a much larger screen to deal with and scale to that. And second, they can't just take their phone interface and stretch it. That's not useful. Like, why you have the screen, why are you paying this money for so much more screen space if all you're going to do is take your existing apps and make them really wide? If anything, it might make the lines of text harder to read or something. But the second thing is, as he opens it up, it's like, oh, well, don't worry about apps. I'm going to open it up and it'll be great as a consumption device. But if it looks like an iPhone or an Android, if it just looks like a phone aspect ratio rectangle when it's folded, when you unfold it, it doesn't become an iPad mini aspect ratio. It becomes an iPad mini in terms of area, like, you know, the square centimeters or whatever. But the aspect ratio is not the same. So if you watch, for example, a television or a movie, like a 16:9 or like a Letterboxd movie on there, there's a huge amount of wasted space. He shows it in the video. It's like, here's an actual iPad mini showing video and I'm holding it in landscape. And here's my N5 showing a video and I'm holding it in a landscape. And the video is bigger on the iPad mini, despite the fact that they're both similarly sized, because the aspect ratio doesn't match. And if you make the aspect ratio when it's unfolded be suitable for like an iPad on its side, like watching videos on a plane or in bed at night like I do, then when you fold it, it looks really weird. Like, it's not phone-shaped anymore. It's this weird shape. So that's another kind of compromise where I'm not sure what Apple's going to do there. Like, what's the correct size? I mean, I presume everyone wants to do what the N5 did, which is like, make it phone size when it's folded. But then when you unfold it, it's like, well, what do I do with all this space? Apple has an advantage there in that I think they'll be able to revise their applications to take advantage of that. There's more iPad apps available. They might be able to sort of port their iPadness to the phone. You know, like, I think that Android has real problems in there for a lot of reasons that Apple doesn't. But watching video is an area that Apple can't control. I don't think an unfolded, foldable iPhone will be as good a video viewing device as even an iPad mini, let alone a full-size iPad.
Yeah. I think it'll be fascinating, as you've said many times, to see what trade-offs, you know, what levers Apple pulls and what levers they push, if you will, and to see where this goes. I'm excited, though, and as Marco said earlier, I think Apple trying new things is good. You know, I'm mostly a fan of the Vision Pro. You know, I think there's problems and foibles, and Marco, I'm sure you're happy to jump in and explain some of them if you'd like. But,
right.
You know, I'm a fan
well
of the
covered
Vision.
It, I think.
I'm a fan of the Vision Pro. And I think that whether or not you, the listener, are a fan of the Vision Pro, I think we should all celebrate that they're trying something. And this is what Marco was saying earlier. And I'm really interested to see what they try here. And not trying anything is one potential answer or option. But I think they will try something. And I think it will be sooner rather than later. And I think it's going to be really interesting and exciting. Same thing with the iPhone Air, if whatever it's called. I'm excited for them to try something super thin. And let me tell you, I still miss my Motorola Razr from the early aughts, or maybe it was mid aughts. You know, that thing was so small and so thin for the time that it seemed impossible. And, you know, I'm sitting here telling you, oh, I don't want an iPhone Air because I don't want to compromise cameras. But man, if it's as cool looking as I suspect it may be, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough, but we'll see what happens.
So see,
what
I'm afraid
about,
to feel
I know we sort of ran through it a little bit here, but what do you think about the gigantic 18-inch folding iPad thing? Because that, I think, is a product without much precedent in the market, mostly because Android tablets aren't particularly possible. And I know there's that we mentioned it in the other store. Like, there's laptops that are like that, essentially Windows laptops that are one big giant screen that you fold. But even those, I think, are not of the sizes being rumored here. What is that? Is that just like random stuff Apple's doing internally? Is that a real product? Is that a MacBook Pro with a screen keyboard, which you used to make jokes about the butterfly keyboard days, that they're just going to make it all screen and you open it up and there'll be a software keyboard? Like, what is that product? And do you find that kind of product enticing in any way in the same way that you might a foldable phone?
I mean, I think the problem with that is, like, does iPad OS allow enough utility to take advantage of that larger size, first of all, and
what if it runs Mac OS?
And to, well, but and then to be worth carrying it and paying for it and all these other, like, so, you know, every device you add to your life has costs. You have to, first of all, you know, monetary costs are huge. Like, you have to buy these things, and iPads are already, like, the high-end of iPads are already very expensive.
Let's double the screen size.
Right, exactly. And add all this, like, you know, crazy folding stuff that's going to be, like, very cutting edge, and, you know, that's definitely going to impact costs in very large ways. So, like, you know, a huge folding iPad, that's going to cost a lot. That's going to have a lot of utility to people to make it worth the money cost alone, let alone the cost of carrying it around. And, you know, where does this go in your life physically? Does it replace a laptop? Maybe, maybe not. You know, there's a lot of, is it a desktop device? In which case, why does it need to fold? Like, there's all sorts of questions here. I mean, but again, like, I'm glad Apple's trying these things. But I think this is possibly going to be an area where Apple's hardware prowess for the iPad family is as always, kind of waiting for the software side of iPad land to provide more utility to more people.
Unless it's a Mac. Again, it's not yet clear what operating system this is running. If it runs Mac OS. And it's basically like the M7 MacBook Pro Fold, and like that's the thing that I'm thinking about is, like, okay, I can see that product. You don't have all the problem. You have to make macOS be touch-based, but who knows? Maybe they're doing that in the big redesign. We'll see. Anyway, assuming you sort that out, what is the utility? And I know there's Windows laptops that do this already. Like, what is the utility of having the keyboard part of your laptop essentially be replaced by a screen? Well, one of the utilities is that if you pick it up and unfold it and it has, like, a kickstand, you can have a much bigger screen. And then you just bring, like, a portable keyboard, like an iPad-type keyboard with you. You know, so it's like it folds up in your backpack, but when you're setting up at a table, instead of having to look at a 13-inch screen or a 15-inch screen, you can look at basically a 19-inch screen or a 20-inch screen. But when you fold it up, it's the size of a 13-inch laptop. when you don't have it folded that way, do you want to use a software keyboard on the screen part that's laying on your desk?
Nope.
Like when it's just open as a regular laptop? I don't want to use a screen keyboard like that. So I don't know if that compromise is going to really be worth it for anybody. Like if you really, really need a portable computer with a 20-inch screen, I mean, they sell 20-inch laptops, I guess, but they're huge. Like, it's just so difficult for me to see, like, what problem is this solving? Is someone out there right now and they're saying, well, I really hate working on my laptop. I wish I had a screen that was, you know, 5 inches bigger diagonally. And in exchange for that, I'll give up my hardware keyboard most of the time. I don't know. This is such a fascinating rumor because it doesn't make sense to me as an iPad product. And it also doesn't make sense to me as a Mac product. But maybe I haven't seen the vision yet.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it would be very specialized. Like, this would not be mass market because it's like, I honestly think the high-end iPad Pro is already somewhat specialized, you know, merely for price reasons alone. And, you know, once you start going, you know, I'm sure this would, you know, definitely be above $2,000, and possibly even above that. And you know, you start looking at like, okay, well, who is such an iPad power user that they would be willing to spend that and carry that around and have all the trade-offs that comes with that. It's like, I mean, those people do exist. They sell the Mac Pro. Like, they, you know, it's probably a smaller market than the people who buy the Mac Pro. But
The problem with the iPad Pro folks is a lot of those high-end ones like use it as like a graphics tablet with the pencil, and now the crease concerns come into sharp focus because try drawing on a screen that has like a subtle crease down the whole center of it. Oh, that'd be real annoying.
Yeah, I mean, that's why like I think is even much more of a moonshot than a foldable phone
because
it's
shoot?
Such a moonshot.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll try not to make that title. No promises.
Cool. Ah. Anyway, this is so much more of a risk than the foldable iPhone because the foldable iPhone, we already see foldable phones out there that have high utility, that are worth their price to a lot of people. I don't think we've ever seen a device like this kind of, you know, dual screen laptop thing or, you know, I don't think we've ever seen anything like that that had any success whatsoever in any market.
Yeah, I don't think I have a place in my life at all for a giant iPad. And I know that there are people that very much want this and, you know, I'm happy for them. I mean, it's just, I don't think I want that in my life. Now, if this was a foldable Mac, that has at least piqued my interest. But as you said, John, I do not want to type on a screen regularly, like a little bit, tiny bit here and there on an iPad or Mac sized device. Sure. But regularly, not for me.
It's like revenge of the touch bar. You know, like you didn't like me and you banished me from your laptop. So guess what? I'm back. And now I'm taking up that whole section of the laptop. It's all screen. It's all just a giant touch bar. How you like me now?
How do you like them apples? Ay. All right. You want to do some Ask ATP?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's start off this week with Anonymous, who writes, "It seems like everyone likes to rail on Apple feedback for lack of transparency, but it isn't just Apple. Anyone who's ever sent feedback or a suggestion knows the pain of the feedback black hole. My suggestions and bug reports for Overcast, Callsheet, and even Witchsmith have gone to DevNull. Should users have any expectation of support? What is one thing you would want your customers to know about support?" And then additionally, Tony writes, "How do you all as individual developers deal with feedback or bug reports for your applications? For each of you, what is your preferred method of receiving feedback? How do you triage the issues reported or enhancement requests? What systems and or applications do you use to do so? Do you target a specific cadence for bug fix releases? How do you prioritize bug fixes with feature enhancements?" This is a lot of questions one ask ATP, Tony. I'd be interested to know how each of you deal with such things since your apps vary in size, complexity, and platform. For me, I don't think that's a fair comparison to compare the operations of single individuals to one of, if not the richest company on the planet. Like that's a very false equivalence. And I do understand what Anonymous is saying, but for what it's worth, I would say whenever I am sent a question about call sheet, I typically try to answer it. And if I'm sent like a bug report or a suggestion, I note it, and to answer Tony's question, if it's something I think is actionable, I'll make a new GitHub issue for it and I will track it. But I just, if all I did was work on support, I would never advance the app. But that's because it's just me. Again, it's just me. There's not time in the day for me to treat support the way I wish I could treat it. I wish I had the time to be able to treat it with the respect that I want to, but I just don't. And I got to assume that, Marco, you feel even strongly the same way, even more strongly the same way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of differences here. I mean, number one, yes, it is a massive question of scale. and you know, to be brutally honest, there's also a question of lifetime customer value versus the time it's going to take and, you know, what is it worth? How much of our time is worth, you know, trying to, like, handhold one person through a problem? You know, when you look at, like, traditional, what we consider support, typically that can range from, I have a quick question and I can type out a 4-word reply, or more frequently, I have a long thing that's going to take you a while to read and understand, and then you might have to do some work to answer it, and then that's going to cost, you know, that's going to take you a half hour or something. And then when you look at the maximum lifetime value that you're likely to earn from that customer, the more of those emails you spend that kind of time on, the more you are losing money. People, I think, develop a sense of customer support based on products and services in their life that they're paying a lot more for, frankly. You know, if you have a problem with, like, you know, your cable service, well, you're giving them $80 a month. You know, the lifetime value of you as a customer is pretty high to them, so they can afford to have somebody answering your questions for you. When you're, you know, looking at an app that you got for free, or maybe you're paying a few bucks a year for, that's a lot harder for that developer to be able to afford to walk you through things or to answer questions individually one by one. So there is that significant difference in scale and in just plain old dollars and cents. And as Casey said, you know, as one person, there's a total amount of time that we have to spend on work every day. And when you are answering individual emails, that is not a great way to leverage the limited time that you have. You're better off kind of taking all the emails as an input and saying, a lot of people are finding this button confusing or whatever. Let me fix that design. And then you make the product better for everyone, and that's kind of an indirect way to fix it. Is it ideal? No. You know, obviously it'd be great if we had time and resources to answer everything the way it deserves to be answered. But when you're dealing with individual one-person types of businesses where they stand to make very little money from each person and they have a lot of emails, that it is not a great use of their time to provide individual support. So the way I, you know, kind of squared this in my head is, I set expectations accordingly in the app. That, I think, is very important. It'd be one thing if you said, email me with any questions you have. Come on, I'll answer them, and then you never did. That's kind of crappy. And if you look at the Apple feedback system and what we are told about it, the problem we have with it is that we are repeatedly told over and over again by lots of people on Apple, you have to file bugs, please. It makes a big difference. They really do matter. And then, you know, the reaction we get when we actually do file bugs is crickets, and it's the system shows us it's wasting our time. Whereas I think what I'm doing by not responding to most emails to Overcast, I think it's different because I'm setting the expectation right up front, right in the app, right where the email form is. I'm saying I will read most emails, but will not respond to most of them because I don't have time to respond to most of them. So I'm setting the expectation before you've even emailed me, and you can, of course, get to that screen before you've paid me a dime. I'm setting right there in the app, I'm probably not going to respond to your email. And so I think, again, in a perfect world, yeah, everybody would have time to respond to everybody, and everybody would get what they want. In the actual world that we're in as indie businesses, where we can't afford to respond to every single thing and give people the support that they sometimes want, I think the best way to handle that is expectation setting, so that people are told right up front before they've invested a bunch of time, you know, going through your process, you can say, hey, you know what, I'm probably not going to respond. And they can choose. They can say, all right, you know what, this app isn't for me then. And sometimes I will tell people who get very mad at me, sometimes I'll say, like, listen, it sounds like you want a level of support that I can't provide, so you should probably use a different app, like, that provides what you want. And I'm fine with that trade-off. I know that not everybody is you know, willing to accept my point of view on this. And like, for those people who demand a more engaged developer or team behind their apps, there's other apps out there that offer that. And I accept the reality that I'm going to lose those people to those apps. That's fine. I accept that. To me, I've made that, you know, cost benefit analysis and decided I'm not going to change the way I operate my entire business for what seems to be a fairly small percentage of the audience that really can't take the way I do it.
Yeah, the thing I'd add is I would imagine when people hear us give the our usual answer to this is like, well, Apple's the biggest company in the world and has billions of dollars and we're individual people. They might think to themselves, okay, but also Apple has way more customers than you. So doesn't it all even out? Like, because they may be huge, but literally billions of people own their products. So it seems like it should be the same. And this is what I would say. Like, if you are an individual developer, like you don't have a company, you don't have any employees you're hiring to do support or anything, it's just a single person. If you are successful enough with your app sales for it to be any kind of reasonable income or any kind of reasonable augment to your income, like if you make maybe not enough money to just live off your app, but like enough money that it's not just pocket change, like you're really helping support the household with your app, that means that you have too many customers to support individually. So like the ratio, like if you are even remotely successful as an individual, you have too many customers that you can't spend your time responding to them. Like there's no business unless you sell like, I don't know, you sell an app for $50,000 and you sell like two copies of it or something. Like there's no business that you can have as an individual where the number of customers is tractable, where you do have time to give people individual support. And also that your business is successful. Because if you have an app and two people download it, you can spend all day emailing with those two people and supporting them at a very personal basis. But two customers is not enough to support you unless your app is tremendously expensive. So, and I know because I'm usually on the other side of that because I have three apps now. They are not particularly successful, which means that I don't have that many customers, which means when customers email me, they're much more likely to get a response. And it's not because I'm nicer than Marco and Casey. It's because I have fewer customers.
And
I would love to have
nicer.
The opposite problem, right?
But yeah, you're also nicer.
Yeah, but this is the real thing, right? But still, even with the amount of customers that I have to make the same exact trade-offs, which is, you know, some customers who email me about apps, like they gave me $5 once 5 years ago, and I've spent just, you know, dozens and dozens of hours going back and forth over the course of months helping them debug a problem. Why am I doing that? Is it out of the goodness of my heart? No, because one of the things that you have to do as an independent developer is, like Mark was saying, figure out how best to spend your time. And if there's some problem and some bug that never happens to you that you can't reproduce, but that you know some portion of your customer base has, if you get one person who like contacts you about that bug and they're willing to be like your remote debugging buddy, the time you spend with them is going to pay dividends for all your other customers and maybe for a future version of your app or whatever. Like you're spending a lot of time with them, not to help solve their problem, but because that person is helping solve a problem that lots of other people have experienced. And it's basically the interactive version of what Margaret was talking about is like, if you take your feedback in aggregate, you can figure out where the pain points are and concentrate on them. But if you're trying to find a problem, like, oh, I know this is a problem on my app, I can't debug it because it never happens to me, but I know it's happening to customers out there. What you need is like one hero to come through and like someone who is just, they want to get it figured out too. Why are they doing it? That's not their app. They're not going to benefit from this bug being fixed. Or maybe they just want to participate in bug fixing. And I treasure those people because sometimes you need just one person out there who's got a problem, who's going to pull the logs for you and go back and forth and figure it out. And then you figure out like, what is the problem? Why does this not happen to most people, but it happens to some people? And you just narrow it down. And that's the trade-off that I do with all of my feedback. It's like, if it's a two-word answer, fine. If it's just, you know, if it's 17 pages of me trying to debug their entire life, they're just not going to get a response at all. But if I know there's some problem somewhere or there's some issue or whatever, like in Switch Glass, I had such problems with, like, screen identification of, like, you know, figuring out which screen is this for a variety of both hardware and software-based reasons. Hardware having to do with, like, identical monitors lying about their serial numbers, and software having to do with how Apple exposes which monitor is which. And this is like a core functionality of my app, assign a different palette, you know, Switch Glass thing to each individual screen, and you want it to always remember, this is the screen on my left and this is the screen on my right. And from a user's perspective, you're like, how dumb is this app? I can't tell this is the screen on my left and this is the screen on my right. But from a software perspective, it's like, I don't know where your screens are, man. I just got to call APIs and hope I get IDs back. And getting someone who could debug that with me, like, what screens do you have? Can you take a picture of the back of your screens? Can you run this test program for me that dumps a bunch of information from the IO registry? And like, that really helped me fix some problems early on in Switch Glass. And all the Switch Glass users benefited from that problem being solved. So a lot of people, especially listening to the show, they think like apps are just like a fun thing or like a privilege to be able to make them, and that is all true. But like Marco said, it is also a business, or in my case, attempting to be a business, and so you have to think like a business person and budget your time and money wisely. And sometimes that means massively over engaging with one or two people, and sometimes that means ignoring a whole bunch of them, and sometimes it means figuring out what you have to do to improve your app so that you actually do get more customers, so then you have so many that you have to ignore them. It's not easy being an indie developer. It's trade-offs all the way down. But I just want to say is that the trope about Apple is big and we're small, so we should be excused, even acknowledging that they also have more customers, the math just still doesn't work, because to become successful as an individual, you have too many customer support. And there's this gap, by the way, when you have enough customers to be significant, but before you have enough customers to hire a support person. There's this gap where it's like, we really should hire a support person, but we can't because we don't have enough customers. And eventually you get enough customers that you can hire someone and should hire someone to do support for you. But I don't think any of us have really passed that threshold. So yeah, business is tricky.
Tom Bullock writes, in big corporate software, it's often said that big bang releases are bad and small incremental releases are good. They're good for the company, certainly, and you might be able to argue that they're good for users in terms of avoiding a huge deluge of new bugs at once. As Apple has also moved this direction in the past few years, it makes me wonder, what about delight as a user priority? The experience of going to a new major version and having a bunch of cool new features spring to life now seems diminished, since all the features are sprinkled out over the year. It makes me wonder whether we've traded away something important in order to get more stability. I hear Tom's point, but I think I prefer it this way. I like having incremental releases, and we're actually going to talk about something that I'm going to be releasing real soon in the after show. But it doesn't mean Tom is wrong by any stretch, but I kind of like the status quo. I don't know, John, what's the right answer here?
Yeah, so are we missing out on delight as a priority? Like the experience of having a cool new, big new version with cool new features in it? The thing about the like big bang releases and like just a release where you change a whole bunch of stuff is that is not a formula for delight for the end user, really. That is a formula for you broke tons of stuff that worked before and all the new things you rolled out are buggy. There's the essay from Joel Spolsky from 2000 talking about things you should never do, part one, quoting from that. The single biggest mistake Netscape made was that, no, I'm sorry, I mangled it. I'm going to fix that. Bloop.
Cool.
How is this correctly? I put the brackets around it. Anyway, in the essay, Joel writes, Netscape made the single worst strategic mistake that any software company can make. They decided to rewrite the code from scratch. As developers, we all know that instinct. Look at all this code. It's cruddy. It's cruft, tech debt. It's built up. It needs to be redone. Let's redo it all. That is sometimes a good instinct, but the right way to do that is still in incremental pieces with the goal of eventually replacing it all and doing important parts first or whatever. But you can't do all that work internally and just like say, oh, we're working right here and we won't release until we've rewritten everything from scratch. And then one day we'll have the old thing and the next day we'll swap out the old thing and put in the new thing. Just ask Sonos if this is a formula for
stick burn.
Delight. But it's not just Sonos. Like, it's so hard to do that and not end up angering more people than you delight, because the old code has all the bug fixes in it and all the wisdom of all the people who've left the company. You can read the Joel Spolsky article. Like, that's why it's accepted wisdom that you shouldn't give in fully to the desire to just wipe the slate clean and start over, unless you've made the wrong app, in which case make a new app or whatever. Like, obviously doing a pivot or going in a new direction or whatever. Like, there are ways that this can work. That's one of the things that I hated about the Spolsky article back in 2000. I'm like, but this is wrong. There are cases when you should do this. But his larger point was like, even, and he didn't hedge about this, which is what you didn't hedge back in the 2000s when you were a blogger. Anyway, you should never, ever do this. That's the wrong lesson. The lesson is you will want to do this more than you should. That's the lesson. That's mm-hmm. that's the sort of like more accurate, less sensational early 2000s blogger thing. We know you want to do this, especially if you're a programmer, but you should resist that and only do it in careful ways under certain circumstances, yada yada yada. And that is a very boring blog post to read, so it's much better to say this is the single worst mistake you should make. You should never ever do it. And as evidenced by 25 years later, people will still quote this article and say, well, Joel Spolsky said you should never do it, therefore you should never do it. There are cases where you should do it. Maybe Siri should be rewritten, but it's so much more prevalent, it's so much more desirable, it is so hard to resist that you should narrowly undo it. And it's because rewrites like that do not delight your users. They don't delight you either. Everyone is sad. Everything breaks. Stuff that used to exist doesn't exist anymore. All the new stuff you rolled out isn't as good as you thought, and it's all buggy as hell, and you sign yourself up for another decade of finding and fixing bugs that you already found and fixed before you get to the point where you can find and fix the bugs in the new stuff you added. So I disagree with this questioner. We are not missing out on anything. If anything, Apple should be more judicious with the features it rolls out, and maybe more judicious with the features it announces, because the real way to surprise and delight users is to take the features that you know and love and use every day and make them better and better and better over time. Polish them. Remove long-standing bugs. Make the performance better. Like, just, there are, you know, people use features every single day, day in, day out. Make those better. That's how you delight users.
Also, I mean, in all fairness, you know, I think Tom's question here, it isn't just about like big rewrites. I think it's more about like the features that we're already delivering, instead of staging them out like on every, you know, 18.1, 18.2, 18.3, like, you know, having each one of those deliver a chunk of what was announced at WWDC, instead, like, have the one big release in the fall deliver everything that was supposed to be in that OS, you know, major version, as opposed to, like, you know, month by month by month. So there is certainly a question of, you know, whether, you know, dropping everything all at once in a big bang is better. And in certain ways, that is better. That is definitely better for making a big splash in marketing if it's hard for you to get a lot of attention otherwise. So, like, it isn't hard for Apple to get attention. Apple can, you know, fart and they'll get attention from all the major press outlets, you know, so they can do whatever they want. They can stage stuff out. And when you have that kind of status, it's actually good to trickle things out, because then you kind of stay in the press constantly. There's always something that you are doing that's new in the press. Whereas,
although I don't think that's why Apple does it, because Apple used to do the thing where all the OS features were supposed to launch in the 0.0. But I think that there was a reason the 0.0s were just way buggier. Like, they so clearly, they used to release features that were at the same doneness state as the ones they don't release now, but they just released them anyway. And guess what? In the 0.0, it was buggy. In the 0.2, some bugs were fixed. In the 0.3, some bugs were fixed. In the 0.4, it finally worked. Now they just hold it for the 0.4, which I think is the right decision, because I think the Big Bang release, despite us being excited by seeing it at WWDC, like, ooh, we're all going to get this as soon as the 0.0 is out, and we're so excited for it. But when we get it, it's disappointing when the stuff is buggy as hell until the 0.3. Yeah. Just hold it for the 0.3.
Yeah, but so anyway, like, if you have, if, like, one strategy for marketing is trickle stuff out to constantly remind people about you. This is why you can buy, like, a single sock from a website once, and they will start emailing you literally every single day after that, telling you all of the breaking news and their sock specials. Like, it before your sock even arrives, you've gotten 9 emails from them reminding you of all the great news happening in socks. And
but you don't think that's why Apple, like, marketing is not dictating that Apple holds things to the 0.3, right? Like, that's engineering for sure, right?
Probably, but I think Apple appreciates the benefit that it, like, I don't think they are artificially holding stuff back to trickle stuff out. I think you are probably right that it is engineering driven. However, I do think that this is a benefit they enjoy, that it does spread the press splash for their stuff throughout the whole year rather than just happening in the summer and fall. But when you are an indie and you don't have the kind of fart attention that Apple gets from the world with everything you do, there is some value to having those big splashes. Like, when you are pretty much anybody who's smaller, even, you know, even like a medium-sized company, like, you know, if you have, like, you know, like Evernote, I think they're dead now, but, you know, something like that size company of, like, you know, if you can make a big, you know, 3.0 or whatever and have a whole bunch of stuff all drop at once in that one big version. And everything John just said about, like, you know, having a big release also having a bunch of bugs, that is true. But that does get a big PR splash. So there are times where you would want that strategy for sure. But when it comes to delighting users, I think, I mean, maybe this is just my style as a developer. My favorite ways to delight users are with small features. They might not even, they might never see an announcement for it, but they might run into it in the app sometime. That is, you know, if you're optimizing for delight, that's a little bit different from like wowing people. I think the big PR feature drops, that's to wow people and maybe get new attention to your app. But if you want to delight your users, I find it way more fun and way more delightful to offer them something helpful or nice or fun at a random time that they weren't like necessarily looking for that, but something helps them and like, oh, cool. So an example of this would be like my undo seek. This has been like when I did the big Overcast rewrite that I should never have done, thanks to Joel Spolsky. When I did that, the big rewrite last year, I improved so much about the app. The thing that people love the most, they constantly tell me they love the most, is undo seek. Because a lot of times it turns out people accidentally seek in a podcast by dragging the bar accidentally with their finger or whatever. And then having the undo thing pop up right there, undo seek, and you tap it and you undo it. That's a very delightful feature to people. It was not a big PR splash, but it's something that they run into when they are using the app. And as you are, you know, developing an app and serving your users over time, you can add little things like that whenever you want. And, you know, the sooner you get it in there, the sooner people are going to start being delighted by it. So I think there is a way to optimize for designing for delighting users, and it doesn't actually require big bang, big drop releases. You can do it incrementally by slowly adding that kind of thing over time.
I think the delight that Tom was asking about is like the Christmas morning feeling of like watching the announcement video and say, oh, look at all these goodies and I'm going to get all of them. And you can continue to think that and just know that they're going to spaced out. But it's just so nice. Like now finally I'm installing iOS N+1 because it's been publicly released. And now I get everything that I saw in that video. And yeah, that's not that was never really a realistic world. Your choices were exchange that great feeling for a buggy 0.0. Or, you know, just have they could just simply announce fewer features and release them all on day one and just release fewer things throughout the year. I think what they're currently doing is a reasonable-ish compromise, which is announce all the things in your big video and then release them over the course of the year. As long as over the course of the year, A, actually fits within the year, which hasn't worked out that well for Apple's intelligent stuff, and B, that you don't get like the last bushel of things in like the end of December, and it includes like really important features. Like spreading it over the year, maybe try to spread it over the first half of the year. Because honestly, if you're planning features and they're taking your whole year to roll out in any reasonable form, you probably put too much into the year. But yeah, like I do think polishing existing features, and I would say the seek undo, that's an example of polishing an existing feature. Seeking, that was done in 1.0. Whatever needs to be done with seeking, but people use seeking all the time. Is there something that needs to be polished in seeking? Well, but yeah, it works fine. Seeking is fine. Like, nothing is wrong with seeking. It's like, but let me really think about seeking. Is there any part of seeking the experience could be better? I'm going to go revisit the seeking feature, which I've never needed to touch because it works perfectly fine. And you find something to add. And guess what? People love it. Not because seeking is a new feature, not because it lets them do anything they couldn't do before, because you could always just slide it back and figure out where you were, but it makes some part of seeking better. It acknowledges the reality of seeking, which is sometimes you do it by accident. Let the app help you out there. Polishing existing feature like that, I wish macOS had this. I wish it so bad. Like every single thing I do every day in macOS is like, this has been this way for 10 years and has not improved. Please, just somebody work on this one feature. You know, I mean, my bugbear is like file sharing in the Finder. Those dialogues, that whole interface, that whole experience has not gotten better in so long, and I do it every single day, and I wish someone would come and give me the Finder file sharing equivalent of undo seek.
You know, bringing both these AskATPs together, my favorite support email to get, which I always respond to, is, hey, just FYI, you know, you have all of these ages for these actors on, you know, this movie, but they're all wrong because, you know, Pierce Brosnan isn't 35 anymore. And that's what it says he is in, you know, Goldeneye or whatever. I'm making all this up. And I get to respond and say, no, that's how old he was when it was released.
But and, that's a design bug, I feel like. If yeah, people are actually misunderstanding it, you need to make that clear in the interface.
Thank you for ruining my moment, John.
I'm just saying, like, it's both. It's good that you get to delight them, but like, oh, that's really useful. And now they know that, and from that point on, they will be delighted by that aspect of your application. But also, it shows that there's
maybe
a part
put
of the
like a little tiny text above that says like then 35. Like
it's not an easy. If it was an easy problem to solve, you'd already solved it. Like all of our apps have situations like this, which is like, how can I make this clear without cluttering up the app with a bunch of instructions that once you know it, you never need this again? Because I don't need that instruction. I know about it, but I know about it because I talked to you. Like, but if I had just seen it without any information, would I have known? This is one of the problems of app design. That are you optimizing for the first user who knows nothing, or the user after that, or do you want your application to adapt to it? You might have already made the right trade-off, which is don't put anything, and if anyone doesn't understand what it is, they'll write you and you'll tell them and they'll be happy, but you know, it could be better.
Well, and actually, now that I think about it, I embraced Tipkit just the teeniest bit when I did the big multiple lists. I almost said rewrite. It wasn't a rewrite necessarily, but the multiple list feature. And so now that I've gone down the Tipkit line, for lack of a better word, you know, perhaps the right answer is to add a tip for this. So the first once or twice that they see it, they'll get the little pop-up that says, hey, this is how old these actors were when the movie was released, and then they never see it again.
And then they send you an angry email. Why is this thing popping up tips in my face? I don't need you to tell me to use my app. Get this thing out. You know,
I got one of those.
Everybody.
I got one of those. It was so obnoxious. It was on Mastodon. It was just hilariously obnoxious.
If you want to say obnoxious, like I posted on Mastodon asking about a shopping list app or whatever, and a bunch of people sent me suggestions, most of which I had already tried. But anyway, in the course of trying all of the suggestions, I saw just how aggressive like the average iOS app is about sending you BS notifications, like the app. And I would be like, allow notifications just because like I want to see how the app works. You know, if notifications are part of the app, if I was going to use this app, I would enable notifications. So I install the app, enable notifications, use it for 2 seconds, close the app, go back to the app store, 1, 2, 3, bloop, notification from that app, instant delete. Like, I don't even know what those notifications were saying. It's like, I've barely even used your app. I just installed it like less than 60 seconds ago, and you're already sending me a notification. It's like, no, delete. I think Tipkit is way below that threshold. But yeah, apps that don't respect, you know, their intrusion into your life. Like, it's madness.
Yep. Hello, Future Marco. I think we should probably stop here.
Yeah, probably.
Yes.
All right.
All right, thank you to our sponsors this episode, Wildgrain, Factor, and Notion. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is called ATP Overtime. This is our weekly bonus topic. Every episode of the show gets ATP Overtime. There's about 15 to 30 minutes usually of a whole other topic that you aren't hearing if you're not a member. So if you want to hear all these, if you just after hearing, you know, 2 hours of us, you're like, the one thing I need is to hear more of these people BS about computer stuff. You can join us at atp.fm/join, and you can hear Overtime every week. So this week on Overtime, the topic is going to be vibe coding, this new phrase that came up, which I find this very amusing. But anyway, vibe coding, we're going to be talking about that in Overtime this week. So you can join to listen. Once again, atp.fm/join. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next week.
So in the realm of delighting users, kind of, sort of, there's been a handful of features that CallSheet either hasn't done or hasn't done the way I want. And I'd been kicking the can down the road on a lot of these in some ways because I was scared of them, in some ways because I just didn't think it was the right time, in some ways because other things were a bigger priority. The number one on the list was having multiple lists of pins. And, you know, we've talked about that already. It launched, I think, a month ago or something like that. And another one that I probably should have prioritized higher, but honestly, I was a little scared of was universal links and a web presence. And I don't mean like a marketing page. I still don't really have that. But what I mean is when you go to share like a movie or a show or a person in CallSheet, I present you with a prompt the way in the released version of the app that says, do you want to share you know, a call sheet link, which is the call sheet :// URL scheme that only works if you have call sheet installed on a, on your device. Do you want to share a movie database link where you just go straight to the movie database? I feel like there might've been one other option. I don't recall, but you have the user has to make a choice. Right. And if they send a call sheet link, like, you know, let's say my, you know, close friends and I share a link from, for a movie, what they're, what's getting sent in like an iMessage is call sheet :// you know, in some URL, which is presented as a completely useless URL in messages. There's no web component to it whatsoever. So there's no poster, there's no title, there's no anything. I have no idea what I'm looking at other than looking at the URL and knowing if it's a movie, a show, or a person. And that kind of sucks, and it's always kind of sucked. And even leaving aside the growth hacking of like having a nice web link to point people to, it's just icky to look at in messages. Like even for people who love the app, you know, I really like the app. And when I send these links to like Aaron or my friends or what have you, they're gross. And so what I knew I wanted to do was have some sort of universal link and like web presence such that when you share a link, instead of sharing :// you're sharing a link to some website. And then when you open that link, it will at the very least, you know, show a presentable version of that website that that you can then from that web page click a link that, you know, sends you into call sheet. Or for double bonus points, you open that URL, say for messages, and it immediately hops you right into call sheet, deep links you to the particular, you know, thing that you were looking at. So as an example, you know, if I sent to the two of you the link to the Hunt for Red October in iMessage, I would expect to see the poster for the Hunt for Red October. I would expect to see the title. I would expect that if you tap on that link, you know, we would open call sheet and dive directly to the Hunt for Red October. And on the surface, this shouldn't be that complicated. But the complicated thing was and slightly because of Marco, but mostly because of me, I have a deep aversion to running any sort of server component at all for any of my apps.
Wise.
I don't want to bother with it. I don't want to mess with it. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to scale it. I don't want to think of it. So that's a large part of the reason why I've been kicking this can. And the obvious answer is, well, you dum-dum, you already run a server for your website. Just tack on the side of that. And yeah, I could, but like my website is old and creaky. See the recent member special. And although it works perfectly for the needs I have of it today, I think extending it for this purpose is not really the right idea. So then I need to like stand up a whole new thing. And do I want to stand up an entire new like Linode, Nanode, and, you know, another VM in the cloud somewhere just to service this? And like, ugh,
yes.
I don't.
Okay, well, I think yes, but anyway.
I don't. And so I just kept kicking this can down the road, and I kicked it and I kicked it and I kicked it and I kicked it. And then lo and behold, and this is the lesson that Marco and I have both learned many times and keep trying to unlearn and then keep getting reinforced that we should continue to do it. Procrastination has saved the day. An extremely kind listener who I did not get blessings to use their name one way or the other, so I'll just call them Josh S. An extremely kind listener late last year said, hey, I'm tired of sending links to people for call sheet that are so hideous. So I stood up my own little baby setup that does it for you. And so what Josh had done was had set up, I forget exactly where he had put it. I want to say it was on Cloudflare, but I'm not 100% certain. And basically these were single serving pages, sort of kind of. And what it would do is it would mimic the call sheet :// URLs, but it was an actual website, right? And it used the movie databases API on the client side to load details about the film or the show or what have you. So you get this really nice landing page for the Hunt for October, and it has the poster, and in the background of the page is like a faded out like image from the movie. And it was just really, really good. And I don't have a link in front of me, and I don't want to swamp his setup, and I don't know how long it's going to last anyway, but it was incredible. And I immediately reached out and was like, holy crap, may I steal this, please? And again, procrastination to save the day. And Josh was extremely gracious and courteous about it and was like, yeah, absolutely steal it. Have fun. And that was months ago. over the last week, I finally decided to get off my butt and actually try to implement this. And this, to make this a little broader and not all about me, I feel like I learned a really good lesson from this experience, because I knew I didn't want to listen to John and stand up a new, you know, VM in the cloud. I wanted to do something serverless, which is a buzzword that I've heard more in the past a little bit, not as much recently, but I've heard plenty of times. And I don't really even know what that means, but I know that it means I don't have to deal with like a full-on server.
I mean,
and
surely somebody's servers are running these.
Sure. So, no, you're exactly
that's
right.
That's what I was getting at when I said, yes, you want to do that. Because I wanted you to have a website. But like what you're talking about now is an implementation detail, which is like, okay, what answers? When I make an HTTP request, what is on the other end of this thing answering my question? And it could be a computer in a rack somewhere. It could be a virtual machine inside a computer in a rack somewhere. Or it could be a quote-unquote serverless endpoint, which is a bunch of software running on a computer inside a rack somewhere. But it does change like your perspective in that, like, am I responsible for running a machine? Am I responsible for like instantiating and running a VM, or am I not responsible for any of that? And instead, my responsibility begins and ends with me uploading a blob of code or an executable into this magic bucket. And then I'm not responsible for anything that runs it. And the only thing that can be my fault is there's a bug in the code that I uploaded, so I should upload a new version of it.
Bingo.
But everything else is essentially not my fault. And that is what it sounds like you're looking for. That is the quote unquote serverless, is like, I don't want any of this to be my responsibility. But there are other trade-offs with quote unquote serverless, which have to do with things that aren't your problem, may become your problem if there's something, like you can't fix them if there's a problem, so you want it to be reliable. And also, surprisingly, costs. Sometimes serverless can save you huge amounts of money depending on what you're doing. If what you're doing is, let's say, extremely simple and low traffic, putting it as a tiny little thing on some existing VM you have could save you more money than paying per request to a serverless thing. So I get you wanting to do it because it's like cool and you haven't tried it before and you should check it out. And it might be the best choice for what you're doing, but also it might end up being way more expensive than putting a static page on the cheapest static hosting you could find.
Yeah. And you hit the nail on the head that I wanted to leverage as much of somebody else's infrastructure as possible and just care about the thing I actually care about. And I think, you know, I'm stealing a little bit of Marco's thunder, so to speak, in that you've said this many times, I believe, Marco, and summarized it probably better than I'm about to, in that, you know, our value add is probably working on the native app, and being a Linux administrator is not really what you or me or John is, well, maybe John, but not what Marco and I are meant to do. And so I don't want to do that for this particular context. And so I decided to bite the bullet. That's probably a terrible turn of phrase. I decided to learn how to do this. And what I ended up doing was looking at Cloudflare pages, which from what very little I know, and I'm sure I'm going to get some things factually wrong here, but the gist is that you can send them static HTML or you can use some very, very, very basic, I guess, web frameworks to do very, very, very basic websites. I think this is kind of spiritually similar to GitHub. What is it? GitHub Pages? GitHub something or other that they'll host a website for
pages.
You as well. It's Cloudflare's cut of that. But the problem is that I wanted this to be dynamic, and I'm putting huge air quotes in there, insofar as I don't want to have to, and I don't have any mechanism really, of sending all the data to this page. Like I could send a title as like query string or whatever, but that would look ugly. And I don't, how am I going to send an image? What am I going to base 64 encode an image and put that in a URL? Like that's gross. That's not at all what I want. So what this website / web page or what have you would need to do is make its own request to the movie database and get the data it needs based on just an identifier. And that's what I did. And so it turns out Cloudflare pages also uses or offers Cloudflare functions, which I guess in turn are just like slightly rejiggered versions of Cloudflare workers, which all of that is to say you can basically push HTML and JavaScript to Cloudflare. And as long as they're not super intensive and as long as you're not getting a gazillion hits, It's, as far as I know, it is literally free for me to host this so far. I haven't paid for an SSL cert, which I know is not that common anymore. I haven't paid, I mean, I already paid for the domain like a year and a half ago, but I'm not paying for hosting yet. Obviously, that could change, and I might need to, you know, I might get so much traffic that I need to start paying them. But the free limits are extremely generous. I don't remember offhand what they are, but they're very, very generous. And now you can go to callsheetapp.com/movie/1669 as an example, and you can see The Hunt for October. And you can do that for people, you can do it for TV shows, you can do it for TV shows, TV show seasons, and TV show episodes. And I'm really, really pleased with this. And the look and feel of it is 98% Josh S. I did change a couple of things here and there, but the overwhelming majority of it was Josh. The JavaScript, again, make air quotes, backend code, so to speak, most of that was Josh. Again, I tweaked it and changed it and so on and so forth. But what I think a couple of big lessons for me that may be relevant to everyone, I guess I'm trying to channel under the radar here a little bit. First of all, this was something I deeply feared, and I was able to put it together in a few days. Similarly, I deeply feared lists of pins, and that took longer. But as it turns out, for both of these, I was capable of it. Like, I didn't think I was, but I was. And I think what I need to take from this, and maybe someone else listening is in a similar position, like, I've been doing this for a long time. I shouldn't doubt myself the way I have been on a couple of these things. Like, normally everyday stuff, I've got that, no problem. But some of the stuff where I'm outside of my comfort zone, I don't need to be doubting myself as much as I do. And I'm pretty decent at my job, and I can figure stuff out. Like, as I've said probably on the show before, and I've said certainly in many times in the past, you know, when I went to school, and I think I speak for all of you probably, when I went to school, I did learn some marketable skills, but ultimately what I learned was how to learn. And I can learn things, and I knew this intellectually, but I don't know, for whatever reason, I just got so scared about this, and I didn't need to be. And, you know, then I was able to put all this web stuff together again, thanks so much to Josh S. And then I was able to, again, thanks to some tutelage from him, get it so that I, you know, when you open these URLs, if the app is installed, it will automatically deep link into the app, which was not challenging, but was something I'd never done before. You have to get, you know, a certain file on the web server in a certain spot. And Marco's probably done all this 15 times, but you put a certain website or a certain page on, or a certain file, excuse me, on the web server in a certain spot. Then you got to report into Apple about, you know, oh, what domain do you bless? And does the domain bless you back? And so on and so forth. But ultimately, I have feared this for months, probably a year now, a year and a half now. And I ended up conquering it in just a few days. So if you're in a position where there's something, be it a work issue or a programming issue or a life issue that you've been fearing, stop kicking that can. Don't be like me. Don't procrastinate, except when it's useful. But don't procrastinate and just give it a shot, because you'd be surprised what you're capable of. And I'm sure there's problems with this. I'm sure someone will find a bug, and I'm sure there will be an issue. But ultimately, it's there, and at least in the happy path, it works. I'm really pleased with it. And the best part of all, gentlemen, is if I need to change something, I change it, I upload it, and I wait about 15 seconds, and then it's live, which is so frigging refreshing. And I know that this is so obvious, but I'm so used to living in native app land where even a test flight takes like 10, 15 minutes to go through. I am so loving the world of the web where when I upload something, I wait a minute and then it's live, and it's delightful.
Some listener out there is very upset that we've had this entire conversation and not once said the phrase AWS Lambda. So now we've said it, so you can all exhale.
That's true. And, you know, I know that there are plenty of other technologies that would work for this. I don't know why I chose Cloudflare, to be honest with you. I just had heard of it.
Sounds like
times.
They have a cheap deal.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the other thing. It's like AWS scares the piss out of me because there's so much to it. There's so many nooks and crannies that I know almost nothing about any of them. Plus, it seems like so much of the terminology is so like domain specific that I would just not even, I would take so long for me to even understand the terminology I needed to ask the question that I don't think I would ever turn to AWS. Now, John, if I recall correctly, you have plenty of experience with AWS. So maybe for you, if you were to go down this route and if you wanted quote unquote serverless, maybe you would jump directly to AWS.
No,
AWS
because like AWS as the market leader is not incentivized to offer as generous a free plan as you seem to be experiencing from Cloudflare. So I will never be at the scale where AWS will make the most sense for me, I would imagine. Marco probably already is at that scale, and we've discussed that many times in the past, but it is terrifying. You are right to be scared. And that's the sort of competitive niche that like companies like Fastly and Cloudflare, like they are able to offer services that are aimed at people like you, like people who are you know, potential customers of many of their services and may eventually pay for them, but right now aren't like need a kind of a user-friendly on-ramp and maybe don't have a lot of traffic to begin with, and they want to get those because they're below the concern of AWS.
Yeah. All right, titles. Where is my doodad? Don't leave the immersion on is a very obvious choice, but it's good.
I don't even know if that was the correct phrasing from the skit. I should probably look up that URL. But
Revenge of the Touch Bar, I suggested but did not say. I thought that was funny.
I really had good intentions going in, but I don't think I can resist Moonshoot. But it's about all the folding stuff.
I mean, that I'll leave that up to Marco.
We're just like goading our listeners into sending us typo things with the missing V and very and now Moonshoot. Oh, you misspelled Moonshot, you know. I don't know if we can risk that one. Let's see what else we have here, but Moonshoot is
I think
really
Moonshoot is fine. If Marco isn't bothered by it, which I don't think you should be, then I think
no,
it's
I'm
fine.
Not bothered by it. I still think, do people not use the verb as the noun sometimes? Like, I guess
no,
people
you have
just
like
say
a present tense, like, you know, I am shooting the gun.
Right.
He is moonshooting right now.
Yeah. All right.
Whatever. Honest mistake, corrected in real time, not a big deal, but moonshoot is funny to say.
All right, let's do it.
Fart attention is also good, but I don't like butt humor in the title, so yeah. Let me see what else we have here.
I did like how red is the red.
That is good. I feel like we've gone to that well before, but
it's a none more black thing. Yeah. That's a reference, Casey.
Yeah, it's Spinal Tap.
Mm-hmm. You see they're doing a Spinal Tap sequel? Has Marco ever seen Spinal Tap?
I haven't seen it. Not. I just knew the reference.
You've never seen Spinal Tap?
No.
Well, I mean, it's not... It's kind of you had to be there type thing. It's like watching Monty Python now, but it's a very important movie, Spinal Tap. And the sequel will probably be bad, but... Oh,
it goes to 11.
It does.
All right. Moonshoot it is. Live... People, we and bootleg people, we are on the 9th, is that right? And then the 14th, so Wednesday and then back to Monday. Two Mondays in a row, actually, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So Wednesday the 9th, then Monday the 14th, Monday the 21st, and then hopefully until summertime, that's it. Famous last words. We'll see what happens.
If current trends continue, every day will not be Wednesday in the next month.
Yeah. Between Marco and me, we have been very bad citizens and very bad coworkers, and we should probably be sacked. It'll be the John show, but at least
you got to defend those Wednesdays. Block out the time in your calendar so your boss can't send you a meeting for it.
Yep, that's what
it is. I'll just ask my kid to change his birthday. That'll work.
All right, goodbye, live people. Bootleg people are hanging on. Goodbye, live people. We'll talk to you soon.